Feeling overwhelmed these days, attacked on all sides, need some outside help? The perfect time to listen to episode 16 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your never give up, never surrender host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. I'm especially looking for more reviews on iTunes, and I'd love to know what you think. Today, my guest is writer-director Anna Remus, who has chosen the hilarious cult favorite sci-fi satire comedy Galaxy Quest. And I, in turn, have chosen Akira Kurosawa's epic samurai masterpiece, The Seven Samurai, both about a group of heroes who band together to save a group of defenseless people under attack by a more powerful enemy. To begin, Anna, why don't you tell us something about yourself?
Hi, I'm super excited for this. It's funny when I told you about some of my favorite movies and then you gave me the combination of Seven Samurai and Galaxy Quest, I was not, oh good, that'll be easy. I kind of was like, wait, I've never thought about how they're similar at all before. But when I rewatched them, I was really struck by all the similarities, which I know we'll talk about. But something interesting about myself, I'm from one of the coldest cities in the United States, International Falls, Minnesota. I'm actually from about 20 minutes south of that in a tiny town called Capitoma, Minnesota, regularly below negative 40 in the winter. Very interesting place.
I don't think I could last there.
There's actually a marathon every winter that takes place in the coldest part of the year in January. And I'm just in awe of anybody who ever runs in the winter period, but much less a marathon.
Right. Let's start with your choice, Galaxy Quest. And first, some information about the film. Galaxy Quest was released in 1999. It was directed by Dean Parasol. It was written by David Howard and Robert Gordon. And it stars Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman, Tony Shalhoub, Sam Rockwell, Daryl Mitchell, Enrico Colantoni, Robin Sachs, Patrick Breen, Missy Pyle, Jed Reese, and is the film debut of both Justin Long and Rainn Wilson. The basic premise of the film revolves around a group of former actors from a once popular TV science fiction series, which now has a strong cult following. But the actors are now reduced to making appearances at conventions and mall openings. But aliens arrive who believe the series was actually fact and abduct our heroes to help them defeat an enemy threatening them with destruction. And our heroes must then decide whether they will be heroes or not.
Yes, and it's noteworthy that George Takei called this movie a chillingly realistic documentary.
And I can believe that. Yeah. So why did you choose this film?
I'm trying to remember how old I was when I first saw it. I think I was probably 8 or 9, 9 or 10. And it was one of the first movies that I identify as, oh, I want to do that. I've watched it, I don't know how many times. I think I got it from my grandpa. I remember that having this VHS tape of it. And I think I got it just kind of randomly from him as like, oh, I think you'd like this. I was sick. I had flu or something. So I was bedridden. And I think I watched it no less than 10 times in the weekend. There was something about it that I really connected with even at the time. And now watching it as a director is interesting because I feel like I'm looking more at the camera movement and like the composition, the more technical aspects of it. I'm a genre director. This is obviously a genre movie. They both are, I guess. For me, genre is like the gateway drug to cinema because I feel like for a lot of people, when you're not immersed in that kind of cinema as an art form, culture, the way that you start learning about movies or enjoying movies or appreciating the art form is through these escapist adventure things that you want to either experience or adventures that you want to have and that you can picture yourself in. I started liking this and I didn't know why. You know, that kind of spiraled into a career in film much later in life.
So do you think it still holds up or do you still have the same feeling for it today? It does sound like you now are more trying to appreciate it on more than just the entertainment value, but on the technical aspects of the film.
100%. It's still one of those movies that I'll go back to if I am having a bad few months. And I'm like, why did I choose to work in this really difficult industry when things aren't going well? It's a good one to rewatch. Now it's really interesting too, from a business perspective, there were a lot of reasons that this movie shouldn't have gotten made, reasons that it almost didn't get made. Both in general, it didn't really have studio support. There were so many starts and stops. Most of the cast either almost dropped out or was not the first choice, was like the fifth choice.
But Tim Allen was, I believe, at least the fourth choice.
Yeah, because the director, Harold Ramis.
Yeah, he was first assigned to it. And he wanted Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, he was first assigned. Yes, and there was like Baldwin, Steve Martin, different leading men. And they all just kind of, for one reason or another, didn't work. And then when Disney was pushing really hard for Tim Allen, then he finally left. Sigourney Weaver wasn't even supposed to be considered. They were like, no, we definitely don't want someone who has sci-fi experience, which doesn't make sense to me. But she was the one who was like, no, I really like this script. I want to be seen for it, and like really pushed.
I read that one of the things that she enjoyed most about it is that she wore, well, I guess you would say fake boobs and a blonde wig. She took to it so much that she started wearing those off camera and wearing them home. And she kind of really enjoyed having that, I guess, shape.
I think the movie gives her a character that feels like it allowed her to be seen in the genre in a way that she hadn't always been. This is coming off of Alien, this huge box office success. The movie itself and the script really does it with women in sci-fi for sure. But then there's some other kind of allusions with Tony Shalhoub playing an Asian character, not even an Asian character, playing an actor who plays an Asian character.
Right.
It makes some subversive statements, but not in a way that, oh, this is what the movie is about. Sigourney's character is a great example of that. She plays this woman whose only job on the show is to repeat the computer.
That's my favorite line of the show.
I love that line too. I've done some assistant directing in the past and I always refer to that line. It makes me think so much of being an assistant director when all she's doing is repeating the computer, and when people start getting upset with her, she's like, look, I've got one job on this lousy ship. It's stupid, but I'm gonna do it. And then she's got boobs that real life or fake in the show are like her claim to fame. And she has a line in the beginning of, well, at least you had a great character. My TV Guide interview was literally just six paragraphs about my boobs.
It's very reminiscent in many ways of Nichelle Nichols on Star Trek, who was going to quit because she really had nothing to do on the show. And then Martin Luther King came to her and said, you really can't quit. There are too many children looking up to you. You're a real role model. And then she decided to stick with the show.
There's also Sigourney Weaver and Tim Allen in the movie. She has a lot of animosity toward him. He kind of clearly likes her. Just like in Star Trek, I feel like there's kind of this feeling she exists purely for that captain character to have a romantic interest.
Yes, a little different though, perhaps, in Star Trek, where it was always the yeoman who was sort of there.
Oh, right.
Or the alien. He finally got to a point where he was sleeping with all the female aliens. Yes, in real life, Nichelle Nichols, I guess, was having an affair with the producer of Star Trek. I first saw it when it came out. This seems to be a line I continually say on this podcast when everybody else said, oh, we saw it years later. I first saw it when it came out. I first noticed it when it came to the coming attractions. Every once in a while, when I'm watching coming attractions, most of them I see and say, oh, that's okay, or that's, you know, whatever. Especially these, the summer blockbusters. Most look like average studio films, nothing that exciting. But there's something different about the previews to Galaxy Quest, and I couldn't explain what it was. But this happens every once in a while. I'll see a preview and I think, oh, I think this is going to be really good. This happened with The Mummy with Tom Cruise, and it turned out that that was one of my favorite movies of the year. And I just saw something in Galaxy Quest that I said, you know, I think there's going to be something really interesting about this movie. So I saw it and was quite amazed at just how enjoyable and clever and smart it was. Mm-hmm. The plot itself and the way everything works out is quite clever. There's a lot of good banter and good dialogue and an amazing cast.
It's got both this really clean structure and really watertight screenwriting in terms of this kind of Wizard of Oz journey of like everyone gets what they need, see the change, and we want them to change. And it's also got, like you said, this super clever writing. It's one of the only movies that I will always laugh out loud. It's part performance, part writing. Some of that was improvised, but a lot of it was just in the original script. The cast is just amazing. And it's funny to hear about all the trials and tribulations of it getting made, because it makes you realize as a filmmaker how, first of all, film is a living art form, which is always very stressful when you're in the middle of it and you're like, no, but I need that actress, or this is going to be a failure. Like, no, we don't get that shot. The whole movie's ruined. When in reality, the fact that your producer is going through a divorce and therefore was crabbier on your second day can completely alter the entire course of your movie. That's in a way really beautiful, because like, what other art form has that so intrinsic in it? And then also you can make it as precious as you want, and you can make this all about you, and you can make, you know, like, this is my baby, this is my career, this is everything to me. You can kind of try to control the product as much as you want to, but at the end of the day, I think every film, even things like this that I, you know, people don't necessarily take seriously, it's for the collective. It's going to be what it wants to be. Tim Allen gets cast instead, so you freak out, but now it's like almost unthinkable of it without Tim Allen.
That was one of my hesitancies about seeing the movie, was Tim Allen. I never really watched Home Improvement all that much, mainly because I didn't like his character. I have to be honest to say, I don't think much of him, particularly as an actor. But he has a certain narcissism that he has in real life and in the show Home Improvement that in many ways fit very well here.
Yeah, it's funny. I watched Home Improvement. I mean, at that point, I was pretty young. I was 6, 7, 8. But my parents watched it. I grew up in a really blue-collar environment, fairly conservative environment. It was definitely seen as kind of the height of comedy. So I maybe had a nostalgic connection to him, but I was never like, oh, he's a great... like, even as a kid, I was like, Alan Rickman is God. I think you're right. It seems like from some of the stories from the set of how he behaved, that is kind of who he is a little bit.
He's like William Shatner, I guess.
Yeah, definitely a little peacockish. It sounds like there were times that it was challenging to work with him.
You seem to have some stories about how it almost engaged in some of the difficulties. Do you have some favorite stories about that?
So one of them is that Tony Shalhoub auditioned to play Guy, probably my favorite character actually in the film. He kind of sneaks up on you, and Sam Rockwell is just amazing. Tony Shalhoub auditioned to play Guy, and then they ended up giving that to Sam Rockwell, but they were like, hey, you can play Fred Kwan. And he was like, well, that's an Asian character. And they were like, yeah. And he's like, well, I'm not going to do that, but I'll play an actor who plays an Asian character. And they were like, okay. And so they were trying to figure out kind of what his character was throughout the entire movie. And at some point, I think Tony Shalhoub kind of referencing this David Carradine story when he was in Kung Fu and he was you know, playing an Asian character, and he was just constantly stoned. He would just come out of his trailer super high and then be like, all right, let's roll. So that's how PG-13 stoner. Like, they never referenced that kid. I had no idea why he was snacking all the time.
And he also has this sort of glazed look on his face as well.
That's one of my favorite lines in the, when the ship is falling apart toward the beginning, when they really don't know what they're doing, and they show the engine room, and in the background there's just complete chaos and like people flying and sparks. He's like, hey guys, so they're telling me the ship can't take it, it's falling apart, just FYI. And it's so funny because he's just so calm the entire time.
One of the things I was going to ask you, who your favorite character is, you said that was the Sam Rockwell character.
Yeah, I think it's Sam Rockwell's character because he's the plucky comic relief, which they identify him as later in the movie. He's just down for the ride and trying to kind of hitch his wagon to these people without knowing where that's going to take him and how badly that is going to kind of turn out.
Then he turns into Bill Pullman from Aliens.
Yeah, that was one of his first bigger movies. He really committed to that role. There's a great scene where they're landing on the alien planet and he's just freaking out because he's worried he's gonna die. The entire movie is worried he's gonna die because he doesn't have a name. He was saying in the behind the scenes, someone a behind the scenes piece, that he drank 4 cups of coffee and took 2 Excedrin and was just trying to get himself really amped up so that he was actually really annoying. And I just think you can see how excited he was about the role throughout the whole movie. But he also almost didn't do it. He was about to drop out, and then apparently Kevin Spacey convinced him to do it.
Yeah, I guess wasn't sure he wanted to do comedy or he didn't want to do sci-fi.
Yeah, it's funny that sci-fi is kind of a hard sell for people. I think they think they're going to get pigeonholed into it.
And they usually do. One of the interesting things about Galaxy Quest is that pretty much what happened to the people from Star Trek, which is what happened to the people that are dramatized here, none of them really made it anywhere outside of the show. And the ones who didn't do it till years later. Leonard Nimoy kept trying to get a more serious career going, and he would do stage work. When Shatner kind of realized that he was never a very good dramatic actor. In the Star Treks that are pure drama, he's pretty terrible. But he was a really good comedian, really good farceur. And when he realized that and did some great stuff on Third Rock from the Sun and some other shows.
Usually played playing to himself. His strength.
Right.
I was honestly more of a Star Wars fan growing up than a Star Trek fan. But I went to a sci-fi convention at one point when I was a teenager called Convergence in Minneapolis. The actor who played Chewbacca, whose name I'm forgetting, but he's like huge. And he was there, but, you know, and he was in his 60s at that point. This was probably 10, 12 years ago. And I was like, why are you in Minneapolis, Sheridan?
My favorite character, I would have to say, is Alan Rickman, Alexander Dane, the failed Shakespearean actor.
He's hilarious. And the fact that Alan Rickman loved this movie and says it has great writing is a testament to how great it is.
He really, really wanted to do it. He's marvelous in it. He is the best actor probably overall in the whole show. And I think it makes a perfect companion piece. If you've ever seen A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where he plays the perpetually depressed robot.
Yes.
He says, nobody listened to me. Doesn't matter what I say. I think I'll just go over here and not do anything because nobody cares and it doesn't matter.
He just has such a sweet journey in this movie because he's so funny when he's jaded. At the beginning, when they're doing that gig at an electronics store and he says his line that he hates. And he's like, by grab Thor's hammer, what a saving. But then in the end, he learns how to be a hero to the people that look up to him and embrace whatever he is now and not have to kind of fit this standard of being a great Shakespearean actor is like really beautiful.
What are some of your favorite scenes in the movie?
Starting with the heavier one is the scene where Tim Allen's character apologizes to Mathazar, who's the leader of the alien victims. It's one of those moments that always surprises me because I'm like, oh shit, like Tim Allen can act. You feel how upset and how pained and how completely low he is. Sigourney Weaver's performance supporting him is great. That moment where he has to confront the reality that he's not this infallible. Like, because the whole thing that pushes us forward is in the beginning when he overhears someone saying that his fellow actors hate him and that he's a has-been and from these guys at the convention who are making fun of the other people at the convention.
It's apparently really happened to William Shatner, I guess.
Did it really?
That's what I read.
That's horrible. When I rewatched this, I was really struck by first time we see all of them, which is at the green room at the convention before they're about to go on stage. This movie does such a good job of an amazing ensemble piece. Immediately, right. It puts you in the middle of everything going on, but you also care about all these people. And in that scene, when they're all in the green room, you immediately get what everybody's problem is. Chen is just like in his own world and eating and just there to be funny. Alan Rickman's character is suffering because he feels like his career is a joke. Gwen, the Sigourney Weaver's character, is trying to hold everybody together, but also is sick of not being taken seriously. And Tommy Weber, the pilot, is forced to be an adult. I guess he doesn't believe in himself or he's not sure about his skills, but he's also asked to be something that he's not, which is a grown-up kind of role to these people who can't take care of themselves. And then you see Tim Allen burst in and be like, ah, I'm here to save the day, and they all just despise him.
It is, in many ways, a very well-written scene. You do feel like these people have just been with each other for way too long. They all know each other too well. It's the same old thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And they don't particularly like themselves, but it's the way they make money.
Yes, and it does a really good job, too, of humorizing the more jaded parts of this industry. That paradox is always really interesting to me. People who don't like each other making something that people desperately love. You make this giant cult classic fake TV show that people are obsessed with and have all these questions about, have crushes on the characters and like get married and have themed weddings. But, you know, but then at the end of the day, these people that are working together just despise each other.
I certainly agree with all the scenes you've chosen. I like almost any scene that Tony Shalhoub is in. One where he's watching things and he's just eating popcorn. And I also love the scene where they're on the planet and they see these cute little aliens. And Sigourney Weaver goes, oh, they're just so cute. And someone says, I don't think you should go out there. And then all of a sudden they bar their teeth and they all converge on an injured one of their people.
That scene has, I think, more great lines than any other scene in the movie. There's the line where they're watching them and because they're supposed to be the miners for this at this mine, but they look like children. Alan Rickman goes, oh, those must be the miners, like as in the miners of the mine.
Yeah.
And Tony Shalhoub goes, yeah, they're 6 years old. And Alan Rickman's like, miners, not miners. And also the line where they're running away after they see them attack the injured one. And Sigourney Weaver's like, we gotta go before one of those things kills Guy. I don't know why. It's so hilarious.
Why do you think the film didn't do as well as it should have? It did make money. It cost like $45 million to make, and it made $90 million. But generally, it was considered not to have done what they really wanted it to do at the time?
I think for a studio movie, it was seen as unsuccessful or like borderline unsuccessful, which is kind of part of why it's earned the title cult classic, because you can't really be a cult classic if you're successful at the time. But a big part of the behind the scenes reasons why it didn't do so well, but arguably why it's also such a great movie, is because it was DreamWorks. It was a studio film. But at the time, DreamWorks was working on Gladiator and something else pretty big. The director has said pretty outright that it felt like Mommy had a few different children and they were not the favorite child, which was kind of good because in some ways she wasn't watching them. So they could kind of do with it whatever they needed to. But it sounds like the marketing really suffered and the studio didn't give it the attention that it deserved. And so there was a story of like afterward, Jeffrey Katzenberg went up to a few of the cast and the producers and was like, we really fucked up.
You said something earlier that I thought was very interesting, that movies like this were sort of like a gateway drug. If you're really interested in cinema, as a sort of metaphor for that, I was much more interested in reading when I was growing up. And I would read, first of all, more genre things. I would read a lot of mysteries, Agatha Christie, and then I would read comic books. And my parents, bless them, would buy me weekly all these comic books. And I would just read them until I think it was almost eighth or ninth grade, where I sort of said, why am I reading comic books? Then I started reading books again. And I did start reading books that were made into movies because I was starting to get interested in movies. So I read like The Maltese Falcon, and I read 1984 because I saw the movie. And then as I went on, I just started expanding and expanding and expanding. And I think that, yes, that can be very true for people who are very interested in films. When I was young, every Saturday I would go to the children's matinee at the local theater where they would have some sort of stage show and then they would have a movie and then you would sometimes get to stay for whatever was the main feature. But the movies were always either Hammer horror films, Japanese monster film, or sword and sandal epics. I look back on most of them now, and I know that, boy, these really aren't most of them particularly good. Mm-hmm. But they are the ones that got me interested in movies. And once I started watching more and more movies and started watching movies outside of that, then I wanted to watch more, and then I wanted to watch more and wanted to watch more. What I do find unfortunate, I think sometimes today among new filmmakers that I talk to, like on Facebook, even people I know, is yes, these films are the ones that got them interested in movies, but they can't seem to get themselves to go beyond them. They won't watch foreign films. They won't watch anything before 1960. Won't watch independent films. If it's not a studio film, if it's not a comic book movie, if horror film, if sci-fi, they're just not interested in watching it. Not only that, they don't seem to understand why they even should as filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a really interesting time, I think, right now. Film is more accessible than it's ever been. The art form is more accessible than it's ever been. Right. Anybody can film. People film movies on their iPhones that get into Sundance. The gate is just wide open in a way that has never been before. But at the same time, I think the craft and the concept of craft in terms of directing, I think because of that, people don't feel the need for craft as much. What people have to realize and what young filmmakers should realize is movies like Galaxy Quest, you watch them for a reason. They catch your eye. This is one of those movies you're scrolling through the channel, nothing's on, and this is on, and you're like, oh, what is this? And then you just keep watching because it's so good. But at the end of the day, this was made by people who studied filmmakers like Kurosawa. None of these people made these movies just being like, oh yeah, like I'm just gonna have fun, throw this away. But in the middle of the film, the aspect ratio changes in this movie.
Right. There was a problem with that at the beginning because the projectionist weren't fully informed of this, and so they weren't parting the curtain once it goes from the TV show to the story itself.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is even these movies that we maybe don't take seriously or we associate purely with fun and fluff and sugar and rainbows, at the end of the day, they have a foundation of real craft and filmmaking and artistic decisions.
One of the things I often say is that everybody wants to be the next Tarantino, the next Coen Brothers, Scorsese, Spielberg, but so few of them are willing to do what those people did to get to where they are. And in almost all those cases, they just watched thousands of movies.
It's not all about film school. I didn't go to film school. Most of my friends who were working didn't go to film school. It's about self-education and it's about being willing to learn. I like to work with the concept of classism a lot in my movies and especially in things I'm making kind of coming up. There's something at play here with that and with the idea of pretension for me. I'm kind of on the tail end of it. Being pretentious or being seen as pretentious is the ultimate sin. As long as people don't think I'm pretentious, I'm fine. And I don't know why I think that's just because I came up in this really, like I said, blue collar, really low income, technically background. Mm-hmm. My parents are super pragmatic and I was distilled from that. But I'm personally right now learning to get past that and learning to try to go into everything with an open mind and just say, you know what? You can call me pretentious. You can call me a hack. You can call me whatever. You know, there's multiple.
Just don't call me late to dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Just don't say that you didn't feel anything when you watched this.
In closing out, is there anything else you might want to add?
I've been reading a lot of David Mamet, his film books lately, and really connecting to it. I read somewhere that he really loves this movie. I thought that was interesting. I read On Directing Film again recently, and I was really struggling to get one of my scripts to kind of work into his philosophy of really breaking down each shot as essential, not using any kind of voiceover or like any kind of explanation other than visual explanation. Like, you shouldn't be telling people what to think. It's simplicity is what draws you in, but then it's also, I think, what shows how sophisticated it really is. It's great storytelling, and then visually it doesn't try to do anything super fancy. Like, I don't know, it's just a great movie.
Well, with that, let's move on to my choice, Akira Kurosawa's The Seventh Samurai. First, some information on the film. The film was released in 1954. I should maybe say that that is the year I was born.
So you didn't see this one right when it came out?
No, this one I did not see when it came out. I can safely say that. I will get a lot of these names wrong, so hopefully people will bear with me. But it was directed by Akira Kurosawa. It was written by Kurosawa, Shinobu Hashimoto, Hideo Oguni, and it stars Toshiro Mifune, Daisuke Kato, Isao Kimura, Minoru Shaku, Takashi Shimura, Saiji Miyaguchi, Yoshio Inabe, and those are our seven samurai. The basic premise of the film evolves around a farming village in the 16th century Japan. When bandits threaten to steal everything from the village once the harvest is done, the village tries to hire samurai to stop them, but they have nothing to pay them with. However, they've managed to find seven who will work for no more than rice for their pay. So when did you first see the film?
I first saw this in college. I don't think it was part of a class. I think it was just experimenting and trying to teach myself. I wasn't a film major. My college actually didn't have a film major, so I knew that I was interested in film, but I just started by watching movies and reading articles and books and trying to get a foundation myself. I think the first time I watched it, I was probably either a freshman or sophomore in college.
And what did you think of the film?
I was struck by how modern a lot of the composition felt. You can watch this film or the Kurosawa film, and then you can watch any Spielberg film, which is what was popular at the time. And even before you know how to describe it, you just see the similarities, all the movement in the frame. His use of foreground too and background action felt very modern, which is obviously the reverse of what's going on. Like, it informs current stuff, but even though the story was so foreign to me because I didn't know anything about the culture at the time in 16th century Japan, I did feel a connection to the way it was being told.
But it is interesting because Akira Kurosawa does make another movie after this called The Hidden Fortress, which was a huge influence on Star Wars.
So, I thought that was interesting. I was reading that even though he became so well known for the samurai genre, this was his first samurai movie.
Yes, that's very true. And it was so successful that he did keep on making more samurai movies. So he interspersed them with traditional dramas as well. What did you think about seeing it again?
Seeing it again, honestly, I've been in a period recently, you know, now we're however many months into quarantine. I feel like the first few months I watched a ton of movies. I read a ton of scripts, time to catch up on all the things I've missed. And now this past month and a half, I've been working a little bit again, but also getting really into books and reading, not watching as many movies, because I've found that watching movies, it's very easy for it to feel like work. It's really hard for me to watch things now. Brain just goes to like, oh, this is that shot, and oh, they use this, and you know, like, unless it's something that I've never seen before and it can kind of catch me off guard, it's easy for it to feel like work. Watching it again, I kept pausing it and replaying it and just taking a minute to think or breathe and then play it again, because I wanted to make sure that I was trying to just watch it for enjoyment and not do that. But it's hard with someone like Kurosawa. Like, he's a master. Literally everyone references him, and I noticed a lot more about his use of shadow this time around. That was fun. I was trying to watch for the movement, what the camera was actually really doing, because Galaxy Quest uses a lot of movement. There's a lot of sequences where the camera is moving the whole time, but it goes from like pushing in, and it'll go from shot to shot to shot, and each shot is pushing in. So when they cut together, it feels very seamless. It was interesting to see some of that in Seven Samurai. Not exactly that, but the way he cuts on people's movement, it doesn't even feel like a cut always. Someone will be getting up, someone will be running into a place, and then the next cut still has them running, so it has that same smoothness.
For the battle scene, he used three cameras. One was from a distance, so he could get it all. I can't remember the second one, but the third one was the one that actually got in close and would record things close up. It's all very chaotic, but at the same time, very controlled.
Yeah, he definitely uses a lot more close-ups. He does a lot of face-on, like when a character is saying something important, just a very close cut to them. But a lot of cutaways, too. That was something I noticed in Galaxy Quest, is it didn't really do that. They tended to stay at a distance. I think part of that was that he always wanted to have a few people in the frame. There were very few moments that it was only one person at a time, which I'm assuming was to just kind of get that whole ensemble piece feel.
Right. I first saw Seven Samurai like you did. I was in college, so yes, I did see it long after it had opened. I enjoyed it very much. The second time I saw it was here in LA at the Egyptian Theater, the American Cinematheque, which is a revival house and an art house. And it was almost a little reluctant to go because it's 3 hours long. It's like 3.5 hours. Did I really want to sit through a 3.5 hour movie? I think it was a restored version. But what I had forgotten about from when I saw it in college is how much humor there is in the film. And I kept thinking, if this film wasn't so funny, it might have been difficult to sit through.
I know. On the rewatch, I really enjoyed the sequence when they were vetting everybody. And he has the kind of want-to-be samurai who ends up joining them, attack everybody with a stick. And there's different reactions based on each person's personality. Very taciturn. Right. Almost Alan. We'll talk about this, I'm sure. But there are like some similarities, I think, between the two ensembles or like archetypes. But the very serious one who is ready to just hack him. And then the more like jolly, friendly guy sees his shadow and just starts laughing.
Right. And the swordsman, the expert swordsman, who's very, very serious and very, very stoic. One of the reasons why it does have so much humor is originally it wasn't going to be the Seven Samurai. It was going to be the Sixth Samurai. But as they were developing the script, Kurosawa realized, if this is only Six Samurai, it's going to be really boring because all the characters would be so serious. So he got this idea, and this was very new. I'm not sure you really see a samurai character like this before, but he had Toshiro Mifune and said, why don't you be this character? You can improvise. And so much of what Toshiro Mifune does is totally improvisation. It's what he came up with and said, you're going to be sort of the comic relief. You're going to...
That's so funny. Yeah, and he's the wild card.
And he brings a lot of humor. He also brings a lot of humanity to it as well, as he sort of realizes that, you know, he does have to take things more seriously. And in many ways, he's the saving grace of the movie, I think, because of that humor. It would have been very hard to sit through the whole movie without humor. I mean, Hamlet, if you've ever seen a really good production of Hamlet, there are parts of Hamlet that are absolutely hysterical. There's almost no other way to sit through a really serious drama for a length of time unless there's some comedy.
Yeah, I was really struck by how much he resembled Guy in Galaxy Quest. Kind of, they play the same role. They're the comic relief and they're this rookie. With Guy, there's this very physical tell of like, oh, he's wearing the suit, so he must be. But then you realize he has no idea what he's doing and he's very scared. He's also following them, just like that character.
Kikuchiyo.
He's following them and at some point they're like, can you please just leave? Because he's insisting that he join them.
Right, he wants to be a samurai. And you do sort of finally get his history as to why he does want to be that. And he has this very tragic history.
And that is really the heart of the movie for me, that moment when he admits what happened.
Right. You know, his parents were murdered by bandits. He had to fend for himself. I also felt that he was also bringing the more modern acting style to Japan.
That's interesting.
Know, at this time, they were still very, very influenced by Kabuki theater and by the what over here we tend to call more operatic or even silent film type acting.
Yeah.
Still was very much a part of the Japanese film Kabuki theater, which relies a lot on over-the-top emotions, expansive characters, and big gestures and things of that nature. So you tend to have a lot of people really, really going for, I guess you would call, the last row in the theater. But here he is walking along. He's being very Marlon Brando. He's scratching himself, he's fiddling with his beard and his hair, and he's just being very natural and very down to earth. That was really seen a lot before then as well.
Read something that Kurosawa would have actors do. At some point I was taking a course on directing actors. But they said that he would have actors pick a gesture, like mm-hmm. one gesture, that, and then have them make sure that they repeated it throughout the movie to help the audience make up their mind about who they were or what they were like, what their struggle was. Just make it very easy for people. Which
especially when you have an ensemble piece like that. How do you keep all these samurais? There's only seven of them, but you still have to figure out a way to give each of them a distinctive character,
persona.
Which is what you do in Galaxy Quest as well. Everybody also has their very distinctive personality and character attributes.
That you can kind of summarize in one sentence or a phrase. Very serious British actor, very taciturn swordsman who's like, you know, the jolly one. Or the, I didn't know about the improvisation in Seven Samurai. That's interesting. Because I wonder how much of that was at odds with what Kurosawa told them.
It's hard to say. It is possibly one of the things. I mean, Toshiro Mifune does come to collaborate with Kurosawa for a huge number of films. He's not the only one. Mm-hmm. The one who plays the leader, Takashi Shimura, also is one of Kurosawa's biggest collaborators as well. He is in a large number of his movies. But Toshiro Mifune becomes the biggest star of Japan over here in the West and probably in Japan as well. And this is one of the reasons he really went for this character. He created this new kind of samurai. There are some semblances to the samurai, and when he plays a samurai again in movies like Yojimbo, but it was something very different. It was something that Mifune just did very, very well. To a great degree, in many ways, stole the movie right out from under everybody else's noses.
And it's interesting to me how often we see that concept. I can't remember the term he used, but there was the idea that throughout his career, he kept pulling from this kind of group of people that he had that he liked.
Right.
And it's funny how many modern directors took that and ran with it.
Well, yes, that is true. When you find an actor that works well for you and that embodies the kind of movie or hero that you're trying to make, then you constantly reuse them. You have John Huston and Humphrey Bogart, John Ford and John Wayne. That does continue to this day. When you have Woody Allen with Diane Keaton and, well, I'll say Mia Farrow, but let's not get into it. With Spielberg, you eventually have Tom Cruise. And Martin Scorsese, you had Robert De Niro, and then he also got on the Leonardo DiCaprio bandwagon.
Yeah, Quentin Tarantino and Sam Jackson and Uma Thurman.
Of course, when Toshiro Mifune really connects with the audience, you're certainly going to want him to use him in his films for no reason than that. It's going to help at the box office.
Oh, yeah. And when you give an actor a chance and they kind of know that you didn't need to or that you didn't have any reason to, taking a risk on them because you saw something in them and then they're successful, I think they really feel the weight of that relationship and will be loyal to you in
right.
this industry.
I know some of my favorite scenes, one you mentioned was when they were testing the samurai as they came through the door and then Mifune fails the test very badly. But also when the first samurai die and they bury them and everybody is mourning and Toshiro Mifune says, you can't mourn right now. And he takes the flag and he goes up to the hill, puts it on top of the hill, and everybody realizes that they have to rally. They have to keep going. And he becomes one of the people that really gets them back on track. And it does have, in many ways, the same feeling I have for Galaxy Quest. You start out with them defending these people. And then as you go on, you get very emotionally caught up in whether they're going to succeed or not.
And I was struck by that because for all the ways that these movies are similar, I think that's kind of the main difference. In Galaxy Quest, you have such an anti-hero in Tim Allen. You have this whole group of people who, they're not unlikable characters, but in the first scene in the green room, you see all their flaws.
Right.
You don't see them as perfect people, and they certainly don't want to work together. And then you have this group of victims who is just so innocent and almost childlike and who just trust them without any kind of second thought. And so then the eventual journey is these people who are being trusted rising to the occasion of the people who trust them. Whereas in Second Samurai, there's this initial distrust to working together. And there's that scene where samurai arrive and everybody's hiding in their homes and they're scared and they don't understand. And then as they start to work together and they start to trust each other and they explore some of these really deep class issues that I don't think Galaxy Quest ever digs that deep into any kind of social issue, even though I think it alludes to some of the sexism and racism in sci-fi. But this really goes deep into the the struggles of the class system in Japan at this time and all the different challenges of both classes, but especially I think the working class. But yeah, you have this gradual climb into, okay, now we are together and we're stronger, and then, you know, leading up to that final fight.
Yeah, this isn't just fun and games anymore. There are serious, serious stakes here. And then the final series of battles become very, very exciting because they're also very clear about how they're going to fight the bandits. They tell you very, very explicitly how everything is set up and how they're going to defeat them. You even know how many bandits they are, and you see them marking them off as they get them.
You know, then I think they lead to very different endings too, where, you have a happy ending in Seven Samurai, but it's definitely bittersweet. It's a hard won victory. And it's also, I don't think the samurai feel like they won necessarily.
Well, as he says, really the village's victory, but I don't think it's quite as clear as maybe it was when I first saw it. But at this time, the samurai, who were generally employed by the kings, the rulers in different areas, and there were a lot of wars going on, so the samurai were always employed. Then suddenly there weren't really any big wars going on anymore. So the samurai just didn't have any real use. They were struggling to find work. They were struggling to find employment. Right. And it is one of the reasons why they are sort of willing to work for rice. In many ways, what else do they have? That's not the only reason why they're doing it, but that is one of the reasons. And then at the end, the village has succeeded. They kept their harvest. Most of them survived. They defeated the bandits. They won't be bothered by the bandits. And then the samurai are just going to go off into the sunset, and they don't know where their next meal is coming from.
It's interesting too. It's like, I think that's another parallel with Galaxy Quest, is that these people both just got involved in this because they were hungry, or they were desperate, or they weren't working.
Right.
Like, it wasn't a big honorable thing. There's that scene in Galaxy Quest right after, I think it's like first time Tim Allen comes to the electronic store gig, and they're all working and they're mad at him because he was late, and then tells them all about this crazy thing he's just experienced, you know, this real life mission. And they're like, okay, cool, you're drunk. They're about to leave in the cast van, and they're all sitting there, and Alan Rickman is like, he was drunk. Do you really think he was talking about a job? And then they all just stop and look at each other and then leave really quickly. Like, oh, wait, no, maybe he was. That desperation on Seven Samurai, the older man is, oh, yeah, you got to find hungry samurai.
And I think it is sort of interesting that this is one of the best parallels, in that you can take the same basic idea, and on one side, you can make really good pop culture art from it. Because Galaxy Quest is really top tier pop culture. But using the same basic premises and a lot of the same ideas, you can also make this great art film as well. Mm-hmm. We need both. We need both pop culture and great art as a civilization. And I do think it's interesting how you can take some of the same basic ideas and you can use them in such very different and very interesting ways.
Completely agree. And it just goes to show, like I said, that I don't think anything is created in a vacuum. People who made Galaxy Quest were not just randomly watching Star Trek and thinking about how funny it would be. Cinema hasn't been around for that long, and everything builds on each other.
Some more information about the film. Kurosawa had made a number of films before he made Seven Samurai. And before this, he had made the movie Rashomon, also with Toshirô Mifune. Rashomon is one of the more important films from Asia in that it introduced the West to Asian cinema. Sometimes the West, Europe, America, has this idea that if we're not aware of it, it doesn't exist. So you have this movie Rashomon come along that makes everybody aware that there actually is an Asian cinema. Not only is there an Asian cinema, but it existed from silent film days. And suddenly said, oh my God, there are movies from Asia and they're really good. And Rashomon just opened the gates and allowed other filmmakers from that period to come through. I think one of the most popular ones now is Ozu, but also Kobayashi and Imamura. The cost of the film was $1.1 million. It made $2.3 million in Japan. It was the third highest grossing film in Japan. It beat out Godzilla, apparently. In the U.S., there is no real record of how much it made, though it was well-received and did very well in the U.S. But in re-release, it made like $133,000. That was sometime like in the 70s or 80s or even 90s, when I think they got a new print. It's always highly rated on the greatest films ever made. On Sight and Sound, which along with the Cahiers de Cinema list, which generally is the list you go to if you want to find out what are the greatest movies ever made. It started out at 2 and then I think went to 7 and is now at 17. So it still is very highly regarded. One of the ironies or sad things is Kurosawa is not as well respected in Japan as he is outside of it. What I read is when Japanese film critics did a list of the 100 greatest Japanese movies, Kurosawa did not have one on there.
That's so strange.
Japanese critics were turning against him back in the 60s and 70s. I think some of them considered him too Western. He was too influenced by John Ford. He was making too many films with the way that Western directors and filmmakers were making them, and they tended to prefer movies by Ozu, which were more family dramas. And somewhere along the line, he just started losing more and more favor. But over here in the West, still considered probably the greatest Japanese director of all time. It got two Academy Award nominations, one for Best Art and Set Decoration in Black and White and Costume Design in Black and White. So with that, or is there anything else you might want to add about the movie as we close out?
I read something that I thought was funny and helpful to me right now, which is that everything was delayed and it took much longer time to film than everybody thought it was going to. And so the budget kept going up. The producers kept shutting down the film. I read that they did it at least twice, but Kurosawa was just like, you know what? We've spent too much money for them to grab it. And so whenever they would shut down the set, he would just go fishing.
Right.
And just be like, okay, bye. And I love that.
Right. And the delay did cause the final scenes to be shot in winter.
Yes.
And they did say it was a miserable shoot. One of the things I asked you to do is to choose a film or two to go with your choice.
I tried to stay in this genre we've created in this podcast episode of underrated, very basic movies. And so two movies that I think are just not taken seriously enough and are truly exceptional and that I can always rewatch and be like, oh, this is why I love movies, are A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger. It's so good. It draws you in. The performances are amazing. It makes a lot of weird choices, but it's got this modern soundtrack of 70s rock, like taps into the braggadocious personalities of rock stars to show these knights. And then my second one is a sci-fi movie called Serenity, which was Joss Whedon back in 2005 before he was so well known. It was the movie based on his show Firefly, which is a very interesting sci-fi kind of case study. It was canceled after, I think, 14 episodes. It's the definition of a cult classic. The movie was only because fans pushed so hard for it. It's still got this really strong presence if you go to a sci-fi convention. And it gave us a few stars that, like, Nathan Fillion, it was really where he kind of got started. And then Alan Tudyk, I think it was one of the first times we saw Chiwetel Ejiofor. Really well-written film. I watched the movie before I watched the series. In high school, my boyfriend and his family were, like, obsessed with the show. Future in which China clearly has a lot of influence. Everybody speaks Chinese, but everybody dresses like cowboys and it's in space. Like, it's a lot of fun.
Okay.
Great action sequences, great characters. Yeah.
So great choices. I will choose two. One is actually a remake of The Seven Samurai. It is a science fiction film called Battle Beyond the Stars. It is a Roger Corman film.
Love Roger Corman.
Yes, written by John Sayles, starring Richard Thomas. It's actually one of the best Roger Corman films. It's a group of people gathered together to defend another race, sort of like Galaxy Quest, actually. Another one is a samurai film, Hari Kiri, by Masaki Kobayashi, at a time when the samurai are desperate for work. And often what they do is they go from fiefdom to fiefdom. And what they tell the ruler there is that I need food, I need support, and if I don't get it, I will commit harikari right in front of you. And basically, usually what happens is the ruler of the fiefdom is so shamed that they give them what they need and they go on their way. But one fiefdom decides that they've had enough of it. And he tells the person, okay, go ahead, kill yourself. And he does. And that starts a chain of events. And it's one of the greatest Japanese films. So what is next for you? What should we be looking for?
I, like I said, from Minnesota, but lived in Boston for 10 years, worked there. And I just moved to LA March 1st, which is great timing on my part. Like I said, work is starting to pick up again. Out here, I'm really trying to build my branded and commercial base. So I have a commercial next month that I'm working on early in the month. In terms of narrative, I have a film actually coming out this Friday, a short film. It is genre. It's called Keeper. And it's about, I like to describe it when I was pitching it to people. I would just say it's like Taken, but with two white trash sisters.
So, okay.
Two girls that are really not in the protected rung of society. And one of the sisters is a prostitute and in a really vulnerable position and is kind of taken by her ex-boyfriend or kept by him. And so her older sister has to go save her, basically. It's about 11 minutes long. The website for the film is keepermovie.net.
Great. As for me, I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant. So I have a Facebook page called Howard Kastner Script Consultation. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I cover topics on movies and screenwriting. I have two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi horror fantasy short stories. The second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, is available on Amazon. I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast for Pop Art was on Get Out and Upstream Color with stand-up comedian and podcaster Anastasia Washington. The next episode of Pop Art will be on Face Off and Mulholland Drive with screenwriter and podcaster Anne Bermudez. Those movies are about people who either trade identities or they somehow are not the people that they think they are. So once again, Anna, I do very much appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you so much, Howard. This is so fun. Thank you.